Okay, hello everyone, and welcome to today's online event hosted by the International Inequalities Institute here at the LSE. I'm Chico Ferreira, and I'll be the chair today. I'm delighted to be chairing today's event, which is entitled Inequality and the Differentiation of Capital, the Scientific Project of Political Economy, which is a lecture by Professor Facundo Alvaredo. Facundo needs very little introduction. He's a professor at the Paris School of Economics and at the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales in Paris. He's a co-director of the World Inequality Database and of the World Inequality Lab. His research is focused in the fields of public economics, the inequality of income and wealth, and the economic history of capitalism. And I am particularly pleased on this occasion to welcome Facundo into his new role as a part-time professorial research fellow with the International Inequalities Institute at the LSE. We are just absolutely delighted that Facundo will be spending part of his time with us in London. And this is, in a sense, his kind of welcome inaugural lecture in that role. Just before I hand over to Facundo, let me just make three quick points of practicalities here. Please note that we do have a captioner for today's event. If you want to activate the caption, please click the CC button. There should be a CC button somewhere on your screen, at the bottom of your screen. And you can also access larger captions by using the link that's been posted in the chat box. The event will run for an hour and 15 minutes. If you're in London, from 1 p.m. to 2:15 p.m. Facundo will talk for, 40 to 50 minutes, and then there'll be a chance for questions in the final 20, 25 minutes of the event. If you want to ask any questions, please use, this is unfortunately a webinar event, so please use the Q&A box to ask questions, and I'll read those out and select them. So Facundo doesn't have to worry about reading the Q&A. I'll do that. Last thing, our next III public event is entitled Mountain Tales, Love and Loss in the Municipality of Castaway Belongings, which is a beautiful book actually. And it will take place at 5 p.m. on Thursday, the 2nd of December. There's more information at the website. With that, and without further ado, great pleasure to hand it over to Facundo.
So I assume that you can hear me well.
Yes, we can.
So first of all, let me thank you very much, Chico Ferreira, and the organizers for the invitation to this talk at the International Inequalities Institute. I regret very much that this presentation cannot be in person, not that I am wonderful at in-person presentations, which I am not, but I fear that I am not very good at Zoom talks either, where I cannot make eye contact with you. I have no idea of the identities of the people in the audience. So this makes things much more difficult. I always get lots of information from the blinking of eyes in the audience. Zoom, these webinars are mostly like being in a TV set where I can tell you something. I was in a TV set once many years ago, and I promised myself I should not come back. So that's a pity, and I hope that the next time will be in person. So I have first a number of initial warnings. First, well, this is not a lecture. I don't lecture about anybody about anything. Second, I don't lie to you if I tell you that at the start I fear the risks that I am taking with this talk. And I fear that at the end of the talk I will think to myself, I would have been better off showing everybody a couple of plots with top incomes shares or top wealth shares, saying to ourselves, oh, what a terrible situation this is, brothers and sisters, let's tax this and redistribute. But I will not do that today. Third, this is not about the presentation of a paper either. We know the rules of the profession and how the presentation of a paper and the paper itself to be successful must stress the supposed contributions, must be very well delimited, and at the same time must omit or hide as much as possible the problems in it. So I am not very professional at that either, and even worse, I have no intention to become very professional in those dimensions. So this is not about the standard presentation of the paper. My goal today is quite different, and in many ways it's quite the opposite. I want to talk to you about a project, a scientific project started more than 200 years ago, which is living but dormant. And this project, about which you certainly know something, or you may know many things, is the scientific project of political economy. If you want, although this is not totally correct, the scientific project of classical political economy. This project, the project of political economy as a scientific discipline, imposed on itself the responsibility, the goal, and the obligation to understand and explain capitalist society in the context of a general theory, because it couldn't have been otherwise. And let me, not to be clear, but to be explicit, let me repeat this because it's at the core of the argument. The project of political economy, the scientific project of political economy, imposed on itself the responsibility, the goal, and the obligation to understand and explain capitalist society in the context of a general theory. I am not going to say anything new. Let me be also crystal clear about that. There is nothing original in my talk, and I have no intention of faking originality, for I am in great company of the greatest authors of the project. You know that when we talk about classical political economy, there are a number of authors involved, and three stand out, who are Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and Karl Marx. But my presentation, my talk today, is not about individual scholars or individual authors. It's about the project. So you will see that they will not cite many people. And you may ask why this guy wants to talk about political economy or the scientific project of political economy. You may conclude quickly that this would be a talk about the past, old, historical economic thinking, the Ricardian functional distribution of income. And you may conclude also that I have decided to migrate from distribution studies, from the field of distribution studies in which I have been for a number of years, to the field of the history of economic doctrines. No, this is not the case. This is about the present. This is about inequality. This is about understanding inequalities, but today it's not about answers. It's about a path. It's about a project that was abandoned, a project that was on the right track and must be recovered and retaken. Without it, we cannot do without it. My position, of course, I will not have the time. The talk is very short. I will not have the time to fully argue or even convince you about 200 years of economic thinking development. But this should be, at least it should sound more or less quite self-evident to all of you. In economics, as in all other social disciplines, no matter if you like it or not, we have abandoned, for reasons that still have to be explained, we have abandoned the responsibility to think in terms of a general theory. And what we have is a myriad, a multiplicity of partial doctrines. And the development of a partial doctrine may serve the purpose of becoming professionally very successful, and we know that. But this way for the discipline to proceed has left us in the state in which we are, in my view. You may think otherwise. We are unable to understand the present and the past from the proper framework. And this is even more evident in the case of inequality studies. So this is my position. Only in the context of a general theory that develops without compromises and without constraints, and to seek and that seeks to understand and explain capitalism, we can keep the hope to understand the inequalities we observe. Otherwise, we are like Oedipus. I don't know how you feel, but this is how I feel. Otherwise, we remain as we are today, like Oedipus, or if you want a more popular recent example, we are like Bruce Willis in the film The Sixth Sense. I don't know, here I cannot see your faces, so I don't know if you have watched the movie or not, but in The Sixth Sense, I can tell you, Bruce Willis spends the whole film unable to understand what he sees until the very end. Yet, even if he does not understand what he sees, this doesn't stop him from drawing conclusions, most of the time wrong conclusions. And this doesn't prevent him from taking actions with very good intentions, but he's unable to understand what we see, and we should feel ourselves in a very similar situation. In general, and in particular, in the case of, in the field of inequality studies. As Bruce Willis or Oedipus, I think, unfortunately, very unfortunately, we see inequalities, we measure inequalities, and I want to be explicit and clear, we have excelled in developing instruments and data and measurement techniques and capabilities to describe Topinka and wealth share as poverty lines, coefficients, synthetic indexes, etc. But we do not properly interpret, we cannot properly interpret to understand what we observe without a general theory. Without a general theory that develops the three central concepts of economic thinking that I can remind you that are commodity, money, and capital. And if the theories can proceed to be further developed, we should add three other fundamental concepts to economic thinking, which will be the state, power, and history. It is a fact that the political economy project in the 19th century was on that track, but it was replaced, it was abandoned. Some of the reasons we know, then it was abandoned for ideological reasons, it was abandoned because the project had reached very, very nasty conclusions about exploitations, and we don't want to leave. Those very nasty conclusions reached not by Marx, but even by Ricardo, would make very difficult for some of us to get up every morning and go to work. But the fact is that the project was abandoned and replaced by something that did not keep up the obligation and did not keep up the challenge. Let me put you five examples of the orphanhood, which I feel and which you should feel. Example number one, there is an increasing agreement that there should be more taxation and redistribution. This is one of the leitmotifs of the public discussion. Of course, there are pros and cons, and there are people in agreement, people in disagreement, but there is, I should say, an increase in agreement on this. But this is not a new scientific discovery. We cannot be fooled by the state of the discussion. Robin Hood knew about redistribution at that level. We could even say that Robin Hood knew much, almost everything about redistribution, and many before him. But as in our very limited scientific horizon, and I will try to argue why, we treat inequalities almost exclusively, almost purely statistically, because incomes are considered physical flows, wealth and capital are physical objects attached to some rules of private property. Given that this focus on the statistical thinking about inequalities, it is not surprising that the conclusion you reach easily in a very Newtonian way, in a very classical mechanical way, is that you want to change the shape of the distribution. And this is statistically possible on all its happiness. That's all. The thing is just change the shape of the distribution by some, in some way that we will discuss later. But is this it? Can this be it? Can we fool ourselves with that idea? Doesn't this sound closer to the magic primitive thinking in the context from the context of the theory in which we are looking at the problem? Example number two, who is going to change the shape of the distribution? A plumber or a set of plumbers who will design properly evaluated policies that should address outcomes or results or both. This is immaterial. The discussion between outcome and opportunities is part of the problems of the underlying theory. So those are the scholars who conceive economic science in a Marshallian fashion as an engine to solve the problems of the machine. The system as a machine is considered to work pretty well. The forces of competition have produced phenomenal innovation, phenomenal wealth growth, and material wealthness. So the general idea is that we need to keep to protect the forces of competition and produce some kind of redistribution without affecting those forces. Those have to be protected, and the system works pretty well, and those are just small misfunctionings that the plumber will come and know how to fix, or at least we will try to fix. But is this it? Again, doesn't the notion of taxation and redistribution like that, doesn't it sound a bit like the master magician of a primitive community promising the rain after some manipulation? Example number three. Once the plumbers have designed those properly evaluated policies, they will pass them on to the public sector, where there will be a democratic discussion, and the necessary laws will be passed in parliament. Otherwise said, we expect the redistribution to come from something that we call the state. And we stick to the illusion of the state. This illusion comes from Enlightenment thinking, the illusion of the state separated from civil society. Civil society is selfishness and profit and evil. And then the state is the sphere of public good and general interest, which will and which can and should tame capital, foster development, and arrange the forces to generate a more fair society. But is that what the capitalist state as a historical object is? Where does this come from the theory which we have? Fourth, all this process that I have just described and it's on the center of the discussion deal always start with the nation state or with groups of nations, of course, right? Because we have the nation there, we believe that we are forced to take them as given, but are we? And finally, the fifth, when the field, and I'm speaking from the field of inequality, so I'm not innocent here, I'm just expressing my insatisfaction. When we want to turn to explanations, the literature is forced to restrict itself to the identification of what we call determinants of inequality. Returns to education, terms of trade, export and imports, governmental policies, taxation, pensions. But none of these are explanations insofar as we have no theory which has told us that those are exogenous elements. As soon as we leave the Marshallian thinking, the Marshallian partial equilibrium setting, those are not explanations of inequality. Those are not determinants, even if we accept the assumptions for which we decide to call them determinants. So it may be the case that many of you, or most of you, are satisfied and happy with this explanation provided so far, and for the calling for policy implications and policy measures based on those explanations. I understand you. This is the sign of our times. You may be, and we are surrounded by people of action. You need to act, but I disagree. I disagree. As long as we don't have the proper framework to understand what we observe, that this is the right path to follow. There is a good reason for our inability to grasp inequality, in my understanding, is that the sphere in which we live, or the doctrine, better said, the doctrine in which we live, as powerful as it is to study and to understand the market, cannot and will not, it's not its intention, it is right in doing so, it won't go beyond markets. And inequality is one of the examples where the limitation makes itself evident. Observe inequality is the result of interaction between the market, the reproduction system, and the production system. And we should not blame neoclassical economics for being unable to provide us the tools you want to understand conceptually inequality. Statistically, I'm not talking about statistical parts. Statistically, we have excelled, as I said. Conceptually, we lack the theory. And blaming neoclassical economics is like blaming a fridge for being unfit to cook a meal, because neoclassical economics studies the market, and inequality is not entirely determined in the market. So nothing, or very little in these five examples, nothing or very little in these five examples is based on the most advanced understanding of capitalism that we had at our disposal. And this is fortunately or unfortunately political economy thinking of the 19th century. And I say fortunate and unfortunate. It is fortunately because, well, we don't have to restart from scratch. There was a project, the project was abandoned, the project had made phenomenal progress, we must say, it restarted seriously in the understanding of the concept of commodity, the concept of money, and the concept of capital. In that sense, the situation is fortunate. It is unfortunate or sad because we are late 150 years, and we should restart. But I want also to be clear on this. We do not have to start from scratch. This is usually what the position of some of the so-called heterodox economists or the heterodox economics, that they reject everything of the past, and neoclassical theory is rejected, and they want to start from scratch. No, the position, the argument here is that will be that each of the fundamental theories of economic thinking are necessary moments of the development of thinking. So let me now share the screen. And it's a pity for me not to be able to interact with you, because I know at least the talk would have been different. And I will share. So I guess now you can see my screen.
Yep.
And I only have a couple of in this very unusual presentation with no plots, I have only two slides. And for this, so let me summarize, or trying to explain very briefly, incompletely, and unsuccessfully the framework from which I would like to talk to you. And as again I said, there is anything original in my talk, I will use the work and the research of a professor of the University of Buenos Aires that unfortunately passed away very recently, Pablo Levin, who over many years of work and discussion with his students developed this framework for economic science. Of course, this is my interpretation of the framework with my errors, my mistakes, and my limitations. And I should say that we are working on this to make progress on this interpretation with two colleagues, Ingrid Blainert from King's College and Pilar Piquet from the University of Buenos Aires, and many others, younger scholars from several institutions. So let's see if I can transmit at least a part of what I would like to transmit. Let me use a metaphor. I will use a geometric metaphor just to simplify, to make a presentation of political economy thinking, of a new interpretation, if you want, of political economy thinking and why this is relevant now. I will use a geometric metaphor composed of four spheres. I ask you to see there four spheres of different sizes, where the smallest sphere is enclosed in the second sphere is enclosed in the third sphere, and the third sphere is enclosed in the largest sphere. And let me begin with the largest sphere, where I would like to represent economic science in general, defined as the study of the economic structures and relations in human societies, whatever their degree of historical development. So if you want to study the economic relations and structure of the Roman Empire, you are in economic science. The Greek Empire, you are in economic science. The Egyptian Empire, you are in economic science. And the caves of the prehistory man, you are in economic science. But one stage of economic science is specialized in one particular development: capitalism. The stage of economic science specialized in capitalism is called political economy. And this political economy is represented by the second sphere. And here we must say that political economy is composed, and this is part of the framework, political economy is composed by three and only three general theories, which here are represented by T1, T2, and T3, or theory one, theory two, and theory T. This is something that creates a lot of problems with me in discussion with the students when I say political economy is composed by three and by a sequence of three and only three general theories in a non-chronological way. First problem, people usually say, why only three theories? Yes, I'm sorry, I don't have the time to convince you about that, but there are no other general theories in political economy. We have only three general theories. In the same way that in the study of the universe, we have Newtonian theory and Einstein general relativity theory. In political economy, there are only three, and you will not be able to find a fourth one. There is no. What we have is an enormous amount of doctrines, partial doctrines, related to these general theories. You have mercantilism, physiocracy, the economic thinking of the Catholic Church, you have Keynesianism, you have neoclassical doctrines, you have quantity theory, anti-quantity theory, etc., etc. All those are doctrines related to these three general theories and only three general theories. And when I say this sequence is non-chronological, this goes against the general belief that the progress in knowledge and in science is linear and chronological. Well, it is not. The study of the market started in the late Middle Ages. And the most advanced stage of the study of the market is neoclassical economics. Political economy and the study of the reproduction system is a development of the Enlightenment and the 18th and the 19th century. This goes after the beginning of the study of the market and also before neoclassical economics. So progress in these three general theories is not chronological, it's conceptual. And for this conceptual progress, we need to go back and forth in time all the time. The three theories are related, as Einstein, I have added the third a sentence by Einstein at the bottom of the slide. Einstein said, the most beautiful fate of a physical theory is to point the way to the establishment of a more inclusive theory, in which it lives on as a limiting case. Well, this is exactly the relationship of these three general theories of political economy. The development of a theory, the failure of the fate of every theory is to fail, and the failure of a theory gives rise to the second theory, in which the first one leaves as a limiting case. Let me go very quickly on this, in these three general theories. Each theory has, as a general theory, a general law. And we need a name for, we need a title for the theory just for naming purposes. And we call T1, and this is the name chosen by Levine, catalactics. But again, if you want to understand catalactics, or what I mean by catalactics, you just think in terms of neoclassical doctrine. It's the study of the market, and just the market, which is not a small matter, not small matter. But for the study of the market, you can think in terms of the Edgeworth box, or everything you know about valuation, general equilibrium, and the welfare theorems, etc., etc. This theory, this arrangement has very basic assumptions. All members of the society have one kind, only one kind of social relationship. And this social, this generalized social relationship is through the exchange of commodities in the market. And the market is a conjunction of free wills through a contract in which no party can impose a condition. This is behind our general thinking, because this is the dominant neoclassical doctrine in which we live and with which develop. All the rest are, in a way, when somebody doesn't like the assumptions of neoclassical thinking, what they come up with are with exceptions or special cases or contradictions to the basic principles. But the basic theory is that one and dominates. We are not only equal in front of the state from the Enlightenment principles, we are also equal in the market when we bring to the market our commodities, and the market is a conjunction of free wills. There is no power. Exchange is an exchange on equal terms between equals and between commodities which are equivalent. Catalactics, as such, as we, you know, that has a general law. Each theory, each general theory has a general law, and this is the law of market adjustment. The second theory, and I cannot go through how to, what's the case to argue that the movement from theory one to theory two, but theory two is related, if you want, and if you want to understand simply what I'd like to mean, is exactly mostly Smith, Ricardo, and Marx, and the sphere of material reproduction. Abstract political economy has also a general law. It's the law of value, and has an idea or a notion of money, an idea and a notion of capital. And then the third, where we are in this concept today, or where we were at the end of the 19th century, not now, at the end of the 19th century, when the political economy project is abandoned, we are in the limit between the second and the third sphere, in the movement or in the attempt to pass, to go from the T2 to T3. And this progress, this moment of scientific progress is present in chapter one of Marx Das Kapital, but we are not going to discuss this now. The third general theory that we call concrete political economy, which is broadly the scientific discipline to study that studies capitalism, has sold to a general law that we want to call it the law of historical transformation of the system. But these three theories, and some of you may believe that I am a bit crazy, but after moments of reflection, you see that all your economic knowledge fits perfectly in this framework. Each of these theories have developed in a way, in their way, the three concepts, the three main concepts of economic thinking: commodity, money, and capital. So there we have nine concepts. We have no intention, I have no intention, I have no time to go through the three concepts of commodity, money, and capital of the three theories. But as our main interest and focus now is and today is inequality, we need by force at least to focus on the evolution of the concept of capital. And I will not be very detailed, but just let's take a few moments to reflect what we understand by capital so far in the theory we have at hand. And you recognize yourself, and you should recognize all the knowledge about capital, mainstream economics, rightly has about capital. Capital companies, we have capital companies. Capital companies, capital is for this, for T1, for catalactics and for neoclassical economics, capital is a physical object. It's just, it's a collection of physical elements of commodities. Capital companies compete between themselves. And in this competition, with market competition rules, in this competition, the fate of capital companies is to either to the equalization of the rates of profit. This is what's behind all the economic theory we study. Capital is mostly considered to be a physical element, and this is the way we measure it in our inequality studies when we do top income, top shares of wealth or private property. That we believe that we can measure this because we can put price on this. And you know that there is a long tradition of discussion between the Cambridge and Cambridge wrong discussion and debates about the concept of capital. But the main feature that I would like to stress today is that our conception of capital is related for theory one in a collection of physical elements. In theory two, abstract political economy, you know that perfectly, the conflict between wage, capital and labor. In the political economy tradition, capital is a social relationship. Yet, even in the political economy tradition of capital as a social relationship, capitals are qualitatively equal, but quantitatively different. There is no, that's why we can make our estimates, either in K1 and T2. We have a concept of capitals where capitals are qualitatively equal, and that's why they compete, and that's why the rates of profit can converge, and the fundamental assumption of this is an assumption, it's not a result. The rates of profit will converge. But the capitals are qualitatively different, quantitatively different. And in this conception of quantitatively different, we based mainly our understanding of inequality, even if we move from the functional distribution of income or wealth to the personal distribution of income or wealth. I don't know if I can be explicit enough on the consequence of this. This is not a result. This is an assumption of the theory with which we have been working for 100 years. Capitals are quantitatively different, but qualitatively equal. That's why they compete, and that's why we can assume that there is a tendency for the rates of profits to equalize, or there is an equalization of the rates of profits in all the models of micro and macroeconomics that you have always ever studied. You have always an equalization of the rates of profit. If it is not an equalization, if it is because you have introduced some misfunctioning of the system, oh yes, you have introduced monopolies, you have introduced oligopolies, you have rent capturing behavior, etc., etc. But all of them are not at the basics and the foundations of the theory. Those are misfunctionings of the theory, misfunctioning of the system is not the general case. The general case is for the equalization of the rates of profits for capitals that are, I'm sorry if I am repetitive, qualitatively equal. The movement, I am not developing the whole argument here, but the movement from this represents capital The concept of capital for T1, for catalactics, neoclassical economics, as but two for abstract political economy. Marx, to put an extreme example, when Marx told the Germans, the only thing you need to do is to wait for Germany to become London, and when Marx said to the Indians, oh, New Delhi will become London one day, Marx had in mind this idea of qualitatively equal capital that will spread through the world with equalization of the profits rates, making the world a rather homogeneous system. This is the general theory also that Marx had in mind. The problem is that we cannot keep with that assumption anymore. And this Marx or characterized one of the features of the movement between theory one and theory three. And I'm sorry, this is not moving properly. I would like to put an example of why we should, our theoretical work in general in economics, on economic thinking and in inequality studies should abandon, and what would be the consequences of abandoning this heavy assumption of what we call undifferentiated capital. Again, in neoclassical economics and in abstract political economy, in Smith, in Ricardo, and Marx, in all the classical political economy thinkers, the dominant thinking is the concept of undifferentiated capital, capital that's unequal and uncompete. And to mark the fact that we should abandon this undifferentiation idea, this notion of undifferentiation that dominates us and keeps dominating our models and our thinking and the policy recommendations we make, I can put as an example the example of the production, the global production of food, with the case of soy production, not because I am Argentinian and Argentina is one of the leading producers of soy. It's because this is part of one of the most relevant parts of the global production of food. Let's summarize quickly with this case. 80 years ago, seeds were quasi-public goods. That is, they were available for successive uses without payment. So a peasant or a rich landowner, producer of wheat or soy, could use the seeds of previous years for the following years without payment. So this is what we mean, but what is meant by quasi-public goods. And improvements and adaptation of these goods were made by producers or by the public sector. We know very well that in most of these commodity producer countries, there was or there still is some institute of technological or agricultural innovation and techniques, et cetera, in France, in Argentina, in the United States. The public sector, which cannot again be understood as an entity outside the civil society and the economic system, played a role in helping producing the adaptation and the improvement of seeds as a quasi-public good. And the last decades, and we know this very well, we saw the emergence of hybrid seeds. And one of the characteristics of the hybrid seeds is that they lose specific characteristics in the second generation. So the producer has to purchase the hybrid seeds every year, given that the genetic changes are only accessible to a handful of them. So the case was posed, who is the owner of the seed now? And this was the result of the situation is now is the result of the historical development. I think that the first case was presented at the court in the United States, the case Diamond Chakrabarti versus Chakrabarti, where the American court permitted a patent over a bacterium. It was the first antecedent of this discussion. And finally, In 2000, the US Supreme Court confirmed the possibility of granting a patent to a plant, the genes, the tissues, the new plants, and the seeds. And as a result of this allocation of rights, of private property rights, there are only four gene giants that control over 70% of the world seed market: ChemChina, Biomonsanto, Dow DuPont, and BASF. A couple of years ago, when I made similar presentations, there were already six: Monsanto, Bayer, BASF, Syngenta, Dow, and DuPont. But now they have been merged. They control 82% of the seeds. No, they have 82% of the seeds have patents, and these four companies control 85% of the patents. From this, you usually see in public discussion an obsession with the control of patents. Should patents be abolished, etc., etc.? Please, this is not my point. My point is the following. These firms, which have monopolized in a way, have control of the production of innovations generated and produced in the production of hybrid seeds, write additional contracts with producers. These firms, and we know this very well because we know the discussions and the complaints of rich and poor producers in rich and poor and developing countries, the problems of the relationships of the agricultural producers, no matter how rich or poor they are with respect of these companies, are present in Argentina, in Brazil, in South Africa, in Australia, New Zealand, United States, etc. So these firms write adhesion contract with producers. They establish what to produce, where to produce, who the local seed provider is, which the exporting company will be, which the local transportation company will be. These companies do not own, that they don't need to own land. They don't need to own most of the infrastructure capital, physical capital, if you want, in order for the decisions to be decided at the level of the gene giant. So you may have, what we have is a number of producers, in this case of agricultural producers, that may be rich or poor. This is up to our statistical description of asset inequality or private property inequality. But these rich or poor asset owners have no decisions of the economic actions which they are forced to take. This is decided, if you think of this system as an economic hierarchy, this is everything, or most of the decisions are decided at the top of the hierarchy. It shouldn't be surprises in the context if you think that, for instance, the most important rental cars company today own no cars. The most important home rental companies or rooms or home rental company owns no hotels or apartments. It shouldn't be surprising in this context, for instance, that Pfizer, when selling vaccines to developing countries, decided which the transportation company was going to be. Even if there was a case, again, I can cite the case of Argentina, when Argentina wanted to buy Pfizer vaccines and make the transport those vaccines with the national airlines, Pfizer said, no, this vaccines will be transported by DHL. Not because Pfizer owns DHL at all. No, but it is a fact that we need to accept and acknowledge is that the way decisions, the place where decisions are decided are not at the level of the ownership of capital as we keep fixing to believing to understand, but at a level where the ownership of physical capital is not necessary and is not required, and is even worse, is not profitable. So, there are most extreme cases that you won't consider, you would like to consider in the context, when sometimes you listen. This may sound a bit reactionary, but it is certainly not. You may consider the local provider of Monsanto or whatever company sits in a given country. Suppose that this is a monopoly. And the owner of the monopoly provider of seeds, who receives the seeds from Monsanto, is a rich, wealthy company. It's a rich, wealthy company, which is absolutely at the expense of the decisions of Monsanto, because the very moment when Monsanto decides to replace him or her from another provider, his or her capital loses all its value. All the stress is put. So when you see this rich capital owners to complain to national governments because any increase in the rates of taxation will have an enormous impact on their profit rates. Well, in the context of an outdated economic theory, you may not understand those claims. In the context of a theory where you accept that capital is not undifferentiated, but capital is differentiated, and cannot be considered to be the same thing, the capital owned by the local seed provider than the capital owned by Monsanto, you cannot think of a taxation strategy treating the same two capitals just because they are quantitatively equal. No, we have a problem in our, for instance, in our thinking. The idea that capital is undifferentiated and that ownership, quantity, is not, or may not, if you want, given that I am not developing the whole argument, I may not be convincing you. Let's say that if we are led to believe that quantity is not, or may not be, the main variable to be considered, but quality, but the nature and the characteristics of capital in the context of a social relationship, we should stop thinking of inequality, individual or in terms of distribution of capital, etc., as a quantitative term, in quantitative terms only. Because exactly, otherwise it is impossible to understand the claims we observe sometimes by rich asset owners that do not control the profit rate they have. And this is one of the things. They do not control the profit rate they have. It is not only the conflict identified by classical political economy thinking between capital and labor. This was the central part of an outdated classical political economy, the conflict between capital and labor. And this is why the functional distribution of income was the Ricardian idea that sometimes is mentioned when authors and scholars want to recall capital political economy thinking. Well, it is not only that. We should also consider that from the conceptual development of capital, there is something that emerges from the concept of capital, which is power. But not power in the case of the neoclassical political economy thinking. No, it's the concept of power derived intrinsically from the concept of capital. And it is not only power from capital to labor, it is also the construction of hierarchies within structures of capital, where, well, your physical capital is, you may be very rich, but is not the main variable to look at, or is not the main variable to understand in terms of the general theory. Well, because you have control and power, which are not determined in terms of quantities, but in terms of qualities. And we could go on saying, well, where does this qualitative power stem from? And we should get into the idea of the production of innovations in capitalism. But for the moment, if I had a goal, a limited goal, and knowing that the time is scarce and I'm not able to develop the whole argument, the main, not the message, but the main question I would ask you to ask yourself is this, or the main exercise I would ask you to make is this departure from the idea of capitals as being qualitatively equal and quantitatively different. When you think about capitals as qualitatively different, capitals having more power once over the others because of characteristics and conditions that we are not discussing today now, well, the whole place, the whole game should change. The whole game should change. And this is why, perhaps I'm sorry to say this, but this is why many times when we see the series on top wealth shares, and we see that top wealth shares in a number of countries do not go up so fast or so high as we expect. And sometimes the usual answer to this lack of increasing rates is, oh, this comes from defective data. I am sure that top wealth shares must be much higher, so this is a problem of the data. It may not be the case. We can be very well living in a world where top wealth shares, as we physically and quantitatively measure them, are not so high. We may not be going back to the structure of property as in the 19th century. Assets, as we measure them, can be much more redistributed, as Uber with cars, or Airbnb with apartments, or Pfizer with transportation machines. And yet, the control and the extraction and the generation of the profit rates is very concentrated. So perhaps we need to move from this obsession with the quantitative measurement and determination, as useful as it is. Of course, I'm not saying that we don't need to measure. The problem is how to interpret what we see. We do not need to see increase in top wealth shares to have an increasing concentration of economic power determined by the rules of capital through a concept of capital that the theory we have is not providing us. And this is, I guess, all I wanted to say.
Brilliant. Well, thanks very much. This was certainly different and very interesting. I have a bunch of questions, but let me start with one of the questions that we already have. And if other people have questions, you can type them in the Q&A. But let me first of all read a question from Christian Tilsher. Facundo, it says, congratulations on your very inspiring talk. I do like your soy example. Being a physician, I always had the impression that it is misleading to study, quote unquote, the market. It is as if you study, quote unquote, inflammation. This doesn't yield much. You need to study, for example, acute pancreatitis, myocarditis, pneumonia, etc. Transfer to economics, it seems to me that there are very different markets, commodities, and consumers, and so on, and that we should study real specific economical subjects rather than unreal abstract definitions such as neoclassical utility function that aims at representing the standard consumer. Would you agree?
We do each one by one. Yes, I agree, I disagree at the same time. Because no, as a physician, we need theory. We absolutely need theory. And I didn't want to transmit the idea that neoclassical economics as a doctrine is useless, as the orthodox economists usually say. No, the three theories I wanted to present very briefly, even if it was incomplete, perhaps unsuccessfully, are described as three necessary moments of the development of economic thinking. In a way, studying the market is necessary. At the moment, the theory reveals that it is insufficient and you need to move to the following stage, which is the reproduction system. At the moment that revealed that it is insufficient and you move to the production sphere. But studying the market and having models is both are necessary moments of the development of economic thinking, for sure. It's not that the standard market is unnecessary. I don't want this idea to be misinterpreted. It is always difficult for a general theory to make the link with what we may say concrete cases. I have said that because I also ceded to the temptation in a talk in which I cannot see the people to provide an example. But it is not because there is a one-to-one relationship between the theory and those cases, because there's also a difficulty in understanding what we see. The point of my example with the soy case is that it is not difficult to go against the basic foundations of the theory we are using. It is not that power is just it's an anomaly that can be fought, or it is not that inequality, a given distribution of incomes is an anomaly, if you don't like it, it's an anomaly that can be reduced. There are rules in the system, and those rules are expressed in terms of the general theory.
Thanks, Facundo. So I'm going to ask a question now. I don't see other questions, so let me ask people if they have other questions, please add them. So Facundo, I think what you presented, I mean, at least in my mind, it would be possible to separate two arguments, which are clearly related, but which I think may be separable, is my question. So one is the need for a general theory and the resumption of this political economy project that you say ended in the 19th century and needs to return and to replace or at least complement the sort of, you know, multiplicity of little models and things that we have in neoclassical economics. That's one argument. And the other one is the differentiation of capital. And I think you relate them because I think you say that's how you move from the abstract to the concrete political economy in your diagram. But let me ask you question one is whether this is right, what I've just said, in your whether it's right in the sense that I understand you right. Two other sort of sub questions. One on the differentiation of capital. You know, we've people have written models with different kinds of capital, physical and human, for example, but even within physical, private and public capital, which are modeled as imperfect substitutes. So to what extent differentiating between certain kinds of capital in the sense that they are imperfect substitutes, right, in the production of something. Why would that require such a dramatic departure? You know, my question is, can we not differentiate capital by extending a fairly standard approach to production functions, and then people can own different kinds of capital and therefore have different kinds of income that arise from them, and they can be remunerated at different rates. And to the extent that there's different competition in the ownership of those forms of capital, they may or may not have, you know, different degrees of market power. So I'm saying that may not be such a big departure. Is one question. And let me stop there, because I do see some other questions coming in. I had one on the general theory as well, but let me stop with that if you'd like to answer that, and then I'll go to the other questions.
Good. The two questions are related. In a sense, for me, for my framework, are the same. And I challenge you and anybody to contradict this statement. All the capital in all the models we know developed in the since 1900, all the models, no matter how you call capital, in human capital, it doesn't matter, that all those capitals are qualitatively equal. And behind the conceptually, and behind them, there is always the tendency for the profits, for the rates of profits to equalize. you only have the equalization of the rates of profits in the context of a general theory if your capitals can compete, no matter how different they are for your application's purposes. But conceptually, they are all the same. And it is a strong argument, it's a strong statement to say, as I am saying, that Marx, even Marx, had that idea in mind. The differentiation of capital you see, or you want to name differentiation, is not the one I'm saying. For what all the differentiations you see are the same capital. They have some differences, but they all compete. And in competition, they play the rules by the rules of the game, and their fate is the equalization of the rates of profit. If you don't see the equalization of the rates of profit in real life, the theory would say, well, it's a fact, there are some anomalies, but the theory is the theory. But it is true that that capital is an illusion of theory two and theory one, in a sense. Capital is not that. In capital, there is a hierarchy connected with the capability of innovation. But there is a fraction of capital that can always systematically attract a higher rate of profit, a surplus rate. This is part of the theory of the differentiation of capital. When you move from capital which are qualitatively equal to capitals which are qualitatively different, you leave the world of the equalization of the rates of profit. And the theory, the previous theory stumbles down. The previous theory stumbles down. We should forget about that assumption. And in, I know I'm not being clear, but all our discussions in inequality and in the distribution of assets have behind this idea of the equalization of the rates of profit. You want to distribute capital in a way because it's just quantitatively equal, qualitatively equal. It dominates us. I mean, for the first time, like I am saying, perhaps it's shocking or it's not clear, it is obvious, but it is not. It's at the roots of the theory with which we think. Do not assume and do not impose the equalization of the rates of profit, for instance. I cannot hear you.
Sorry, I was on mute. Thanks for that answer. Let me get some more questions here. Juan Palomino has asked two, which I'll put together, and then I'll also read one from Julia Russo, and those may be the last two that you will have time to answer. So Juan Palomino asks, are the qualitative differences you point out in capital based on some capital producing more returns in terms of conventional wealth and another in terms of power? Or is there something else you mean by that? And then continuing the previous question, what are the implications of those different capital types existing, similar to what Chico said? So that's one Palomino. And then the second one from Julia Russo. First of all, thank you, Professor, for the insightful lecture, really food for thought. My question is, may this reasoning allow us to refresh some of the arguments of Burnham about the difference between control and ownership of capital in his The Managerial Revolution in the faraway 1920s. Does it make any sense to take back some elements of such a distinction, which I guess is the distinction between control and ownership? Thank you very much.
Capital has, let's make a distinction between the theory and life. Capital has always been differentiated. This is the beauty of the theory. Now that I can say capital is differentiated, theory three understands that it was a mistake or it was a necessary moment of the analysis of the system with undifferentiated capital, as it was a necessary moment of the analysis, the study of the markets, with individuals considered to be equal, who they are not, what they are not, because capitals are not equal either. capital has always been differentiated. If you want to put example, historical examples, you take, for example, colonial capital. Colonial capital with the state behind is a kind of differentiation of capital. Colonial capital arriving to the new world is a kind of differentiation. It's a kind of external differentiation. But now what we see, what something that Smith couldn't see, Ricardo couldn't see, and even Marx couldn't see, is what we, I would like to call, and in the framework we call, the intrinsic differentiation of capital. It is in the nature of the concept of capital to be differentiated. This differentiation is linked now, it is more, it should be quite evident now, is with the appropriation and the production of innovation. When I say this, I fear in just a short talk and a short lecture that you are interpreting all my words from neoclassical, with neoclassical eyes. And why? Because neoclassical doctrine sees all this. Of course, neoclassical thinking sees capital and sees differentiation and sees different rates of profits and sees monopolies, but it doesn't have a general theory to explain all that. It is, again, those are misfunctioning of the system. Another thing, for neoclassical theory, capital is undifferentiated. Another thing is to say when we are in another theory where the nature of capital is to be differentiated and where power stems from capital. I can be very brutal now. When you say that the concept of capital includes the concept of power, you cannot have the state outside anymore. The state, which is part of your power, is now inside the system, and you cannot take it as to be outside and being the sphere of common good, which will tame capital and foster development. But this I cannot synthesize in 2 seconds or in 2 minutes or in one sentence of the 200 years of political political philosophy thinking. And the second question, I don't know if I remember well. I will tell you something. I won't talk about particular authors today. I made a commitment not to make this a presentation about individual thinking, but about general thinking. But I can tell you, no, I mean, conceptually, this is sad and this is good at the same time. Conceptually, the development of the concept of capital reached a limit in the 19th century, and we are there. This is very sad. This is very, very sad. If there is a concept of capital that has to be the past, as the French say, the passé, is Marx's concept of capital. We need to start from there. Marx didn't have a concept of undifferentiated capital. This is the thing Levin has developed, and we are thinking to further development. But the most developed concept of capital we have is Marx's concept of capital. The rest, no, I'm sorry. I mean, I'm sorry that it is difficult to talk simply about this. The 20th century has been extremely fruitful in the development of instrumental innovations, but conceptually, in economic terms, we are in the 19th century. That was the limit. That's the limit of the second theory. You want it or not, you like it or not. Will this be useful for generating policy recommendations or not? This is another thing. I mean, this idea of the policy recommendations is a separate matter. Marx has showed that the path and the limit. It's his own limit, and we need to build from that point onwards. I don't want to be unfair, but this is one of the reasons, the lack of conceptual progress in the 20th century and the first 20 years of the 21st century has as a result the state in which we are in economic terms.
Thank you very much, Facundo. I did get one more question from Wilfried Altzinger, but unfortunately we don't have time for it. I've already been told by my bosses here that I must wrap up. So I'll ask Dr. Altzinger to please address the question to Facundo by email. And it remains for me just to thank Facundo very much for this very thought-provoking, sort of unusual talk, which was really, really very thought-provoking. To thank all of you for joining us as well, and finally to welcome Facundo once again to the International Inequalities Institute. So thanks a lot, Facundo.